TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Soil is a Living Being, Dr. Christine Jones. Among the ancient elements like air and water, soil may be the most mysterious and complex. After producing the food, farming, and soil programs with Vandana Shiva, that you can hear again anytime on the tucradio.org website, I was happy to be offered this material on soil as a living being from a workshop with Dr. Christine Jones by Fibershed. The nonprofit Fibershed came out of the cooperation of fiber producers, mainly sheep ranchers, and those who are collecting and growing plants for natural dyes, with those who spin and weave textiles. Fibershed is based in San Geronimo in West Marin, California. They chose their name on purpose. Like a watershed, their Fibershed is recovering the plant traditions of a particular region. They make connections with local craftspeople and their supporters. They also recover the cultures of the place and have a clear and active understanding of climate change. You are about to hear an excerpt from a podcast by Fibershed. The first voice is that of Jess Daniels, their communications director.
Welcome to Soil to Soil, a podcast connecting the dots in the life cycle of clothing and material culture, brought to you by Fibershed. Each episode offers a look at how and why our community is working to cultivate fiber and dye systems that build soil and protect the health of our biosphere. In this episode, we're diving into an essential look at soil, from how food and fiber quality is directly connected to soil health, to how billions of microbes are working hard, building soil, storing carbon, and so much more. I'm Jess Daniels, and I'm sharing a unique episode with you, because it's actually not an interview like we typically feature on the podcast, but rather it's a special edition episode. It's an edit of a talk by Dr. Christine Jones. Dr. Christine Jones is an internationally renowned and highly respected ground cover and soils ecologist. She has a wealth of experience working with innovative landholders to implement regenerative land management techniques that enhance biodiversity, increase biological activity, sequester carbon, activate soil nutrient cycles, restore water balance, improve productivity, and create new topsoil. Christine has organized and participated in workshops and field days, seminars, and conferences throughout Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Canada, Central America, and the USA, and has a strong publication and presentation record. Christine is a member of Arizona State University's Carbon Nation team and sits on the advisory board of the Carbon Underground. These organizations recognize that farming and grazing practices designed to improve levels of soil biological activity through the active management of diverse year-long green ground cover are key to the restoration of soil function, clean water, and nutrient-dense food. When Christine was traveling across the Western U.S. in the summer of 2019, she shared two workshops with the Northern California Fibershed community, and so many of us were blown away by what we learned and the way she put this information together that we wanted to bring you an abbreviated and condensed version of these key learnings. And we're able to do that with this podcast episode thanks to John Perulis at Bright Path Video in Marin County, who recorded this audio and provided some of the initial editing. In this episode, you'll hear how modern agriculture has tried to replicate and replace complex biological systems, yet has been focusing on some of the wrong components. We'll learn how food quality and nutrition and crop productivity and soil carbon levels are connected to a vast yet invisible system of microbial life, and how increasing plant diversity and well-managed animal grazing supports microbes to build soil, sequester carbon, and so much more. So without further ado, here is Dr. Christine Jones.
So my background is actually in wool production. My first degree, I have a degree in textile technology and worked in with big wool processors in Australia in looking at Well, my project was looking at the coefficient of variation of diameter of a wool fibre, because as you would know, that if you're involved in the processing, like commercial processing, you know, in the big mills, that you don't want wool fibres breaking during processing, because then they flip out and make things feel really prickly. And so you want everything to twist beautifully into a nice yarn. So for that very fine worsted materials that are used for like Italian men's suits, where you'd pay, you know, $30,000 or $50,000 or something for a suit, you don't want to feel that and detect that it's got prickly, any kind of prickly wool in it. So yeah, so that was my project, and that's what got me really interested in, well, why does the diameter vary over the year, or why does tensile strength vary? And realising, well, obviously it's got something to do with what they eat, and just about everything has to do with what animals eat or we eat, which is the first thing I'm going to be talking about, is what we eat. And then, well, that's got something to do with the way the pasture grows. It's obviously got something to do with the soil, and how is soil quality affecting pasture quality, affecting wool quality, affecting the processing quality, affecting the way that a garment falls when you make it from that kind of fibre. So then I did a PhD in soil biochemistry, which doesn't seem to have very much to do with the wool industry, you wouldn't think, except that it is all connected. So the first thing I do want to talk about today is joining the dots, and in particular talking about our food production, because that is all linked to the soil, and we are all linked through food. And I feel that if there is going to be change globally, it will probably be through the food industry, through people's interest in food, because of how that is actually linked to human health. Most people in the agricultural business are about producing food, and there's something fundamentally wrong with our food production system, because the nutritional value of today's food is far lower than it's ever been in any point in history. And in fact, if you consider the Native American people that would have lived on this land hundreds of years ago, their diet was very, very rich and very high in nutrients, and those people were incredibly healthy compared to the Europeans that now live here today. With all the technology that we have at our disposal, we've managed to dramatically lower the nutrient content of the food that we're consuming. So you'd need to eat twice as much meat, three times as much fruit, and four to five times as many vegetables just to get the same amount of nutrients that would have been available in those foods back in 1940. And by 1940, the nutritional value of our food had already declined significantly. In the early 1900s in the United States, you had people like William Albrecht talking about the fact that the nutritional content of food in around 1910, something like that, was significantly less than it was in 1850. And he was warning the American public at that point that, you know, everything's going to crash here. People are going to die because of lack of nutrients in their food. So that was well before 1940. We know that this is how much has declined since 1940. So this is since 1940. This is well after William Albrecht was making those statements about this issue. So if we look in that 50-year period, the post-war period from 1940 to 1991, 27 different kinds of vegetables. So this is a very comprehensive study. It's the most comprehensive one that I've seen in the world. It's all been published in an internationally recognised journal, the Journal of Nutrition and Health. Copper declined by 76% in that 50-year period. And you might say, well, does that really matter? We've got less copper in our food, so what? Do we need to have copper? Well, yes, you do, because every single biochemical reaction that takes place in your body when you take... And if you look at any biological process where a molecule is transformed from one kind to another, it requires an enzyme. It doesn't matter what living system it is, whether it's in the soil, whether it's in a plant, in an animal or a human, you can't get a change in molecular structure of something unless there's an enzyme there to change it. So, you know, if you're looking at the production of hormones in our body, or the production of, you know, antibodies to some kind of a pathogen, or the things that we need for our immune system to function correctly, they need enzymes, and every enzyme requires a catalyst. An enzyme cannot function without a catalyst, and in our bodies those catalysts are metals like copper, zinc, selenium, those kinds of things. And so that if copper has declined by 76%, it means that a lot of metabolic reactions that would normally take place, particularly those related to our immune function, just cannot proceed. that even if the enzyme is produced, it cannot function if there's no catalyst there. So it is very significant that we have less copper in our diet. It's one of the most important catalysts for enzyme function. Calcium has declined by nearly 50%. You know that's important for the health of your bones and many other things as well. Iron's declined by nearly 30%. You need iron for formation of hemoglobin to carry oxygen. If you're low in iron, you're going to be tired. And how many people these days complain of being tired and not having enough energy? Magnesium is involved in about 300 different biochemical reactions in the body, and we've got like 25% less. And so it goes. And these reductions in vegetables, this same author also found reductions in dairy products, in fruit, and in meat, so that it's all related to the soil. So it's not surprising that we wouldn't see the same depletion in meat because the animals are eating either pasture or grain that's grown from the same kind of soil that our vegetables are grown from. So copper, calcium, iron, magnesium, potassium, all the same things decline. So if iron declined by 54% over that 50-year period, what that means is if you took the same breed of animal, like, say, a Hereford steer of the same age, say, let's say it was 18 months old, it was grown in the same paddock on the same soil type, and you took the same cut of meat, everything was the same. And the same portion size. That portion of meat from 1940 to 1991 would have half of the amount of iron in it. So you could eat the same amount of meat as you ate back in 1940, but you're only getting half the amount of iron because we're animals. So that means that everything in our bodies will, like, look at our bones. How many people suffer from osteoporosis now? So they've got far less calcium and phosphorus and all the things that elements that bones would, people have weak bones, right? And weak muscles. I mean, when you look at the strength of, say, hunter-gatherer type people, indigenous people, how strong they were like 200 years ago, how in Australia they say that Australian Aborigines could run faster than even the fastest runner can today on the diets that they were on. Australian Aborigines had access to 5,000 different food types, like just an incredibly varied, rich diet from incredibly healthy soils, which would have been the same for Native Americans living here in California 300, 400 years ago or whenever, I'm not sure. I have to confess, I don't know what the date was. How can it be that we're using all these high analysis fertilizers these days and making plants grow like crazy and we're not getting any nutrients in our food? So the official explanation for why our fruits and vegetables and things don't have the nutrients in them is that dilution effect. In other words, we're putting so much fertilizer on plants that they're growing at twice the rate that they used to, et cetera, and therefore they've got half the amount of nutrients. That's sort of the way that story goes. But we actually don't see that in practice in like the blueberries that we've just been talking about. If it's high-yielding crops and it's grown in biologically active soil, we actually don't see a decline in nutrient density. So if you're growing your own vegetables at home or you're growing them in even commercially in a way using compost and things like that that's supporting biological diversity in the soil, you will not see that nutrient decline, even though you can have very abundant growth. I'm not sure what it's like here in Australia in summertime when maybe it's too hot and dry here, but when we grow tomatoes and zucchinis and cucumbers and those kinds of things in the backyard in summertime, they just go crazy. You produce far more than you could ever possibly eat. The flavour is just delightful. You know, you can eat raw zucchinis and cucumbers just picked out of the garden and eaten, are so incredibly sweet. So there's no nutrient decline in that food that you're growing yourself if you're growing it in soil where you're using compost or plant diversity or something else to increase the life in your soil. So it's got nothing to do really with dilution. It's also got nothing to do with soil depletion, because if we go out and measure our soils and do a total test, not what's called an available test. So the plant availability tests that labs tend to use are as a basis for a fertiliser recommendation. So a lab will test your soil using a test that will say, oh, you need some nitrogen, you need some phosphorus, and we can sell you this, or we can link you to someone who can sell you this. So it's all designed to tell you that you need to apply those things, and there's a whole industry around that, around applying fertilisers. So the problem actually is that plants can no longer require the minerals and the trace elements that they need from the soil. So why do you think that might be? If you consider now what we would see here in California, for example, in let's look at broadacre. You probably don't use that term, do you? Broadacre, when we say broadacre, we mean like large-scale even organic farms. I've seen organic farms that cover several hundred acres, and they will be just a field of kale or a field of lettuces or a field of just all one thing. And even though it's organic, you actually will have the same issues with low nutrient density in those foods as you would in a commercially grown food. Why do you think that is? So if we had a diverse plant community, a sunflower with a deep taproot can get something that a lettuce with a really shallow, more fibrous root system can't get. And if they were growing side by side, they would actually swap things, because the lettuce can create an environment around its roots that can get some things that a sunflower can't get with a taproot, and they would be connected. Do you know what they would be connected with? Fungi, yeah. So they're going to be connected with fungi, which are like little fine filaments. Some we can see and most of them we can't see with the naked eye, and they would actually connect those two plants. And that's what we call a common mycorrhizal network. They'll mostly be mycorrhizal fungi, and the fungal hyphae will go right inside those roots and then right inside those roots, and they will trade nutrients, trace elements and water and keep each other alive. So whether a lettuce and a sunflower actually have that kind of relationship, I'm not exactly sure. But if we had 20 different kinds of things all growing in together, they would certainly have that relationship. And in the case of the blueberries, they are certainly going to have that relationship with the grasses. Even in a cornfield, say, for example, where people are putting on lots of fertiliser, 85 to 90% of that fertiliser that's put onto that field has to actually be changed by microbes. So microbes have to transform it into a plant available form before the plant can use it. So even applied fertilisers have to go through this microbial pathway. And what that means is that if we're looking in our commercial production systems, like be they grain or vegetables or even tree nuts, that you're either going to have a microbial system there or you're going to have to use fertiliser, because one way or the other, the plants are going to starve to death if they don't get the essential elements that they need. And unfortunately, in most commercial production systems, we've decided to use the fertiliser. So people will use fertilisers and not use these microbial pathways. So today's soils are not deficient in minerals, they're actually deficient in microbes. So what we have to look at then is, well, how do we get more microbes? How do we get more biological activity? We're not going to get that through adding them. We're going to get them through creating the conditions where they can thrive. And in actual fact, when we look at the soil microbiome, these are some fungal spores in soil. It's a very, very diverse and extraordinary world. It's a little bit like investigating a coral reef, except that we can see the things that are going on in coral reefs. When we start looking at soil under a microscope, it's a really very beautiful world and very diverse, and it's something that we certainly have not paid enough attention to in the past. But last year there was a survey was done of life on Earth, and measuring that life, it was a census of life on Earth measured in carbon-based life forms. So we're all made of carbon, all living things, the trees, the grasses, the plants, the animals, we're all carbon-based. And the scientists estimated there was 550 gigatons of carbon-based life forms on Earth, and a gigaton is a billion tons, so this is a lot. And 450 of that 550 gigatons was in the form of plants, which is not really surprising because, you know, when you look around you, like just looking out the window or out the door, you see all that ground cover is plants and the trees. And, I mean, even the fences are made of wood, which was once a plant. So there's a lot of plant carbon around us on this planet. That was not surprising, that 450 of the 550 gigatons of life on this world was in this world was actually in the form of plants. But what was surprising was what made up the other 100 gigatons. So this is the weight of life on Earth. And what the scientists found was that 93% of that other 100 gigatons was in things we cannot see. So when we think of life on Earth, we don't think so much about the things we can't see. So this is the weight of protists, archaea, fungi and bacteria actually comprise 93% of that other 100 gigatons. So forget about the plants and now look at these are the other major life forms besides plants. We don't even register on this. Humans don't even get a look in on here. Protists, archaea, fungi and look at bacteria, 70 gigatons. Of that 100 gigatons of other life forms is in the form of bacteria that we cannot see with the naked eye. In fact, the things that we can see, like the birds out there, though I can hear them, I can't see them, but things that we think of, You know, you look into the sky, you see the birds, you think about fish in the water, you think about the insects. Mollusks are things like slugs and snails, and there's also a lot of mollusks in the ocean. And think how much of the surface of the planet is covered by ocean. It's something like 70%. It's just absolutely teeming with life. So mollusks in the ocean would be things like oysters and clams and pippies and those kinds of things, mussels. They're all in that mollusk family. Annelids are in there as well. And then there's animals like our domestic animals and our livestock and then humans. And collectively, all the things that we normally think of as life, the fish, the birds, the insects, the animals and us, make up 7% of life on Earth. And humans are only a tiny part of that. In the final analysis, we comprise 0.01% of the biomass of life on Earth. So we have certainly punched above our weight, haven't we, in terms of the planetary changes that have come about, the changes in ecosystem function, the extraordinary, in most cases, degradation that has actually been brought about by humans, and we only comprise 0.01% of the biomass of life on Earth. So maybe we need to figure out how to get the other 99.9% to work with us, because if we have caused massive degradation, we can certainly turn that around. And we have the power, we have the knowledge, and if we work with the major life forms, means we actually have to start working with the microbes. I'm going to talk about some of the things that microbes can do. And what I'm talking about, when I'm showing you these numbers here, that's by weight. This is the weight of these things, not by number. So when we actually talk about number, it's even more staggering, because one teaspoon of healthy soil contains more microbes than there are humans on the planet. This makes us feel a bit insignificant. And then if we look at more microbially rich environments like the rumen of a cow or the rumen of a sheep or a goat, one drop of rumen fluid contains 10,000 more microbes than there are humans on the earth. If someone is telling you that they don't think sheep or goats are very significant animals, you can say, well, you know what, one drop of rumen fluid from my goat or one drop of rumen fluid from my sheep has got 10,000 times more microbes than there are humans. The first thing that happens when a ruminant consumes grass or other kind of forage is it goes into this great big fermentation vat, which is called the rumen, which is why it's called a ruminant. So sheep, cattle, goats, no mammals can digest cellulose. We can't digest cellulose, and ruminants can't digest cellulose either. But they have a fermentation vat that all the cellulose is grass and whatever other forages they're eating are made of cellulose. It's the most common compound on the face of the earth, actually, which is not surprising if plants comprise 450 of the 550 gigatons and most plant material is cellulose. Then ruminants are able to grow from eating grass, but they can't digest grass. So the grass goes into the rumen, and the microbes in the rumen digest the grass using an enzyme. Remember, I talked about enzymes, and that enzyme is called cellulase, and it breaks cellulose down into smaller components. One of those are short-chain fatty acids that the animal ingests for growth, and the animal also eats the microbes. So it gets microbial protein from digesting the microbes that are breaking down the cellulose. So it's a symbiotic relationship between a large animal and all the microbes that live in its rumen. It's a very important symbiotic relationship. And we call them ruminants because the first part of their stomach, if you like, is this big vat that's a fermentation vat. That's very important that it's fermentation, because in the gut of an earthworm, they are also undertaking fermentation, and that's why the material that comes from an earthworm, whether you want to call it vermicast or vermicompost, I call it vermicast because what actually comes out of an earthworm is vermicast. Whether it then becomes vermicompost depends on what else you're mixing it with, but their excreta is actually vermicast. So vermicast is incredibly rich microbially because it's just come through a fermentation pathway. So the guts of an earthworm, if you like, incredibly microbially rich. So there are these kinds of environments that are extraordinarily microbially rich, and that's how it should be around the roots of a plant too. So that's what we're getting to is, you know, where are all these microbes and what are they doing? So the overall theme, I suppose, of that introductory part of my talk is that all plants and animals, including us, of course, are embedded in a microbial world. We are carrying, not only do we have microbes on our skin, but we have a microbiome around us that we carry with us everywhere we go. So if you went away on vacation, for example, and you went to a new place, a little cottage in the woods or something, or a little place near the seaside that you had never been before. When you first walk in there, it feels quite strange, and that's, well, you haven't been there before, so there's a familiarity thing there too. And then the next day you go, it feels more familiar, and then the third day you go there, it feels even more familiar. Well, a lot of that is obviously to do with the fact that you've been there before, you've seen it all before, and it starts to feel more comfortable. But the other thing, reason that it feels more familiar, is you have established your microbiome there. And when you walk in through the door, your microbes that you've carried in with you greet the microbes that are already there, or the ones that are already there greet your microbes, and they all say, "Oh, hi, you're back." And you don't realise that's going on, but you actually feel that. So if you go somewhere like into a hospital to visit a friend or a relative that's in hospital and it's all sterile, I hate the feel of hospitals. There's just something about it. It's like, oh, it makes you cringe. And even if you go in there every day, you go in there every day for 3 days in a row and it still doesn't really feel comfortable, right? Or you go in there for weeks on end and it still doesn't really feel comfortable because you're not able to establish your microbiome there because it keeps getting sterilised all the time. And so if you were talking about like a grazed landscape, and you're growing forages for animals, you really need to think about the way you manage those so that you do have lots of young, actively growing roots and root tips. So if you had a grassland, for example, that you just shut away and you didn't have any animal impact, and you thought that you were doing something good for the soil by not allowing animals to go in there, you're not doing anything good for the soil, because plants like grasses need to be grazed. It's very important.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Soil to Soil, a podcast by Fibershed, which is a nonprofit organization based in Northern California on the traditional and ancestral territory of the Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo people. We invite you to learn more about our work and the concepts described here by visiting fibershed.org. And you can find more about Dr. Christine Jones on her website, www.amazingcarbon.com. That's all one word, www.amazingcarbon.com. Love you.
Thanks to Jess Daniels and Fibershed for allowing me to bring you parts of the workshop taught by Dr. Christine Jones. She's an internationally renowned and highly respected ground cover and soils ecologist. She has a wealth of experience working with landowners to enhance biodiversity, increase biological activity, sequester carbon, activate soil nutrient cycles, restore water balance, improve productivity, and create new topsoil. And when you go to the website of Fibershed under fibershed.org/podcast to listen to the full 45-minute talk by Christine Jones, you will also find a dozen links to films, articles, and books mentioned by Christine Jones. I'm going out with thanks to Fibershed and to John Perulis. He recorded the workshop with Dr. Christine Jones on June 20th, 2019. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.